This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we have an update in the legal case against the New York City Fire Department for discrimination in hiring.
Last week, the Court of Appeals in the Second District came down largely affirming the trial court's decision, holding that the New York City Fire Department had for many, many years acted in such a way as to prevent Black and Puerto Rican applicants from getting jobs in the fire department.
As part of our Lawyers You'll Like series, we'll talk with attorney Ann O'Berry.
Ann left a lucrative job in New York City to pursue death penalty work in the South. Today we'll hear from Ann about that work and her continuing efforts to protect civil liberties in Florida and throughout the South.
In a stunning victory, a court in Guatemala found a former official guilty on charges of genocide and crimes against humanity.
It's never happened before. Not only are they putting the former president in prison, he's 86 years old, so he's not going to get out, but the current president was involved with him in the genocide, and the records will show that the United States was complicit in all of it.
Stay with us.
New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, Executive Director of the National Lawyers Guild.
And I'm Michael Ratner, President Emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Michael, we had a bit of promising news last week in the case of Lynn Stewart. We received word that the Carswell Prison Warden's recommendation for compassionate release for Lynn was on the desk of the Director of Federal Prisons, Charles E. Samuels. So things are moving along. The next stage will be to have Judge Codal, the presiding judge in Lynn's trial and her sentencing judge, rule on that motion.
Well, things are moving along. I would say we're on second base. The next step is for the Department of Justice to make a motion to be heard by the sentencing judge, Codal. Codal will then rule on it. If he signs the order, Lynn will be transferred from the prison in Texas up to Memorial Sloan Kettering Hospital in New York City, which is the main cancer hospital in the country, and she'll be treated, and also living in Brooklyn with her son. So we're anxiously awaiting and hope that it works out speedily, because the government hasn't done very much. She had her relapse over 4 months ago and got very spotty treatment.
I think what's important, although this is really positive news, it's critical that everyone remain vigilant in the call for justice for Lynn, and letters should still continue, rallies, op-eds, whatever you can do to keep this case in the public's conscience.
Absolutely. And we'll link to lynnstewart.org, lawanddisorder.org, to help you get the addresses on where to send your letters and sign the petitions. So, Lynn, we were at a rally for you in Foley Square in front of the courthouse last week. We hope the judge got the message, and we are looking forward to coming out and seeing you here in New York City and broadcasting an update for you next week on Law and Disorder.
We talk today about recent developments in the New York City Fire Department discrimination case, known as the U.S. and Vulcan Society v. City of New York. Last week, a three-judge panel of the Second Circuit Court of Appeals held that, in light of the city's, quote, distressing pattern of limited FDNY minority hiring, broad relief ordered by the district judge to end discrimination in the FDNY was, quote, entirely warranted. This decision includes an independent monitor in order to oversee the FDNY's long-awaited progress toward ending discrimination. The court also ruled that the plaintiff's intentional discrimination claim should proceed to trial. The district court had found that the evidence of intentional discrimination was so overwhelming that no trial was necessary. The Court of Appeals also reinstated the plaintiff's claim that former FDNY Commissioner Nicholas Scopetta is individually liable for intentional discrimination. As listeners may recall, U.S. and Vulcan Society v. City of New York grew out of two Equal Employment Opportunity Commission filings by the Center for Constitutional Rights. That was in 2005 and 2002 on behalf of the Vulcan Society. We're joined today by attorney Dana Losia, who's working on the case. Dana Losia, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you for having me.
Now, we've talked about this case a few times on Law and Disorder, but I think for the benefits of new listeners and just to refresh us, could you summarize U.S. and Vulcan Society v. City of New York?
Sure. This case really has grown out of decades of segregation in the New York City Fire Department. In 1973, the Vulcan Society, which is our client, which is a fraternal organization of black firefighters, sued the City of New York and said that the reason why the fire department back in the 60s and 70s was virtually all white was because of the hiring process that the city was using. It was discriminatory. It was unlawful. A federal judge agreed back in 1973 and ordered the city to hire one minority firefighter for every three white firefighters that was hired. Decades went on. We get up to the 90s, and you look at the New York City Fire Department, and it's still 3% African American. A city like New York.
So the city breached its agreement.
The city, I would say, followed the letter of the law. You know, it instituted the quota that was required for the bare minimum amount of time that was required, and then it reverted to the all-white club that the fire department has been for its entire history in New York City. In a city that, you know, as your listeners will know, is 25% African-American or more and 25% Latino.
And part of that reason had to do with the admissions, the qualifying test, didn't it?
Right. So the city for forever has been using an exam which is simply not designed to measure the skills that a person needs to be a good firefighter. It's, you know, we've sort of likened it to having a major league baseball player take an accountant's test to find out if he would be a good baseball player on the field. And it, the test for New York City firefighters has been so irrelevant. And the designers of the test really actually admitted in affidavits that they failed to consult any of the standards that have been published by the federal government since the 1970s and 1980s, and they were using a test that had nothing to do with firefighting.
Was this intentional?
Well, we made the case that not only was the city using these exams, but they were continuing to use them with the knowledge and intent to perpetuate the fire department as it has existed, you know, so that fathers could bring their sons and their nephews and their brothers into the force, and it would stay the way it's always been, which has been virtually all white, over 90% white. Judge Garifas, the district court judge in Brooklyn, agreed with us. He said, you know, this was clearly intentional discrimination. And he issued a remedial order requiring broad oversight of the New York City Fire Department hiring process from start to finish. He appointed a monitor who was going to have to okay everything that the city did to hire firefighters. And guess what? The city really didn't like that. They appealed it to the Court of Appeals. And just last week, the Court of Appeals came down with a decision that largely upheld this very broad and deep oversight of everything the city does to hire firefighters, from the written test to post-exam screening to background checks to physical exams. And the one thing that the Court of Appeals said was that this relief actually is warranted even without a finding of intentional discrimination. This relief is warranted even if this was only an injury and a harm caused by disparate impact, which is discrimination that results maybe from unintentional hiring processes.
What has Mayor Bloomberg's reaction been to this whole process? Has he been defensive?
Mayor Bloomberg, back in 2002, was told repeatedly, not only by our client, the black firefighters themselves, but by the public advocate, by members of the city council, by U.S. congresspeople, by community leaders, religious leaders, there is something wrong with the way the city hires firefighters. every other New York City agency has managed to integrate itself over the years. Every other fire department in a big city across the country is more racially diverse than in New York City. And Mayor Bloomberg's response continually was essentially, I'm going to let my fire commissioner handle this problem. He recognized that it was a problem, but he sort of passed it off to his fire commissioner and sort of said, you know, I'm sure they're doing the right things. They're working on recruitment. We're looking forward. We're not looking back. It was a lot of talk and not a lot of action.
Now, I'm curious, has there been complaints by African-American firefighters of retaliation by co-firefighters?
What's the culture like in the firehouse for these few black firefighters?
I'll tell you, one of the really disturbing things that has happened in this case is that when Judge Garifas in Brooklyn first issued the remedial order that he intended to impose upon the city, he gave members of the fire department, current members, an opportunity to come to court and to voice their objections, to, you know, say to him why he thinks this oversight, back pay for black firefighters, retroactive seniority for black firefighters was inappropriate. And people really came out in droves, not only firefighters, but lieutenants, captains, battalion chiefs, came out and said, essentially, these applicants failed the test because they won't be able to cut it. There's no place for them in the fire department. And it was horrifying. It was very disturbing. And I think the judge issued a decision saying that it was clear from what he heard at those hearings that New York City has not done what it needs to do to make the fire department welcoming to these victims of discrimination.
So are we talking about black New Yorkers who are going to get jobs in the fire department or the ones that already have them?
Yes. The court has ordered that 293 positions be offered to black and Latino applicants who were harmed by these tests, which were given starting in 1999. And those victims have been identified. They're currently going through screening, they're passing medical exams and psychological exams, and they're getting ready to join the fire department this July.
I've got to say that from an outsider's perspective, this kind of job has inherent risks of its own in terms of, you know, running into burning buildings. It would seem to me that to add the additional layer of the potential of discrimination from your co-workers in a dangerous situation would be a very stressful environment. Is there going to be a mechanism in place where these newly hired individuals have a complaint mechanism if harassment occurs?
Yeah, well, part of the remedial order and part of the oversight that the judge ordered in which the Court of Appeals affirmed is monitorship of events in the fire department that could undermine the remedial order by, you know, really making these victims feel like there isn't a place for them or that they're not safe. You know, back in the 80s, when a court ordered the city to hire women as a result of discrimination case that was brought by a firefighter named Brenda Berkman, women came into the fire department and faced horrible harassment and retaliation. And what we're trying to make sure happens is that anything like that that occurs now is immediately sort of raised to the level of the court's attention and dealt with. And, you know, we're definitely going to make sure that these firefighters are safe.
Because I know that in the police department, if you have a partner who doesn't have your back, that they can retaliate that way by putting you in an unsafe situation.
Yeah. Firefighting is very, very based on teamwork. You know, everyone has their role. I think that firefighters do recognize that the team has to work in order for everyone to be safe. So there is some incentive there to really make the team cohere and make it work.
Dana, stop me if you think my take on this is wrong, but I think that firefighting is not one of those really dangerous jobs. It's not like deep sea fishing in Alaska or coal mining. There's a mystique about it, but in fact, it's a pretty good job. I think firefighters work only a few days a month. I used to see them when I lived on Bleecker Street in the fire truck coming down Bleecker Street, and they would stop at one little Italian specialty store after another. They get bread and fish and vegetables and so on, and they go back to the firehouse and cook. It had all the aspects of a tightly knit white men's club, and a well-paying one where people retire after 20 years, or they get graduate degrees while they're firemen, or they get second jobs after they retire. And I think it was such a desirable job, as well as being a white men's club, that perhaps explains the resistance to people other than white people getting into it.
One of the really interesting things that we've learned is that firefighting is far less dangerous than, for example, construction work. It's a less dangerous job than being a police officer. You know, it's a far less dangerous job than being a roofer. And by the way, it's a far less dangerous job than sanitation. New York City sanitation is a quite dangerous job in terms of not only injuries, but also death, you know, out on the roads. So in terms of the mystique, as you called it, firefighters are revered as heroes. They're loved. They're appreciated wherever they go. And the job is much, much more safe than sanitation work. But you're right. You know, firefighters work about 8 days a month. They work 24-hour days. And then, you know, a lot of them use their time off to pursue other careers or education or raising their kids full time. So it's one of those jobs that is so amazing to have. It's really unlike any other city employment that you start to understand why it was guarded so closely.
I think we missed our calling.
Yeah.
All three of us. Well, tell us, where do we go from here?
Right now, we're implementing the remedial phase of the case. The victims of the city's discrimination are going to be getting job offers and back paychecks. And in terms...
Back paychecks to when they had taken the test and qualified?
Yes. Yeah. Good. And yeah. And those who actually are appointed to the job will come in at top pay. You know, they won't come in at the pay that an entry-level firefighter would have earned because, hey, you know, they probably should have been hired 10 years ago. In terms of the intentional discrimination claim, we now have the opportunity to have a trial to prove that the city was doing all of this for decades with the knowledge and really the intent to maintain the fire department as it has been, as the white men's club that it's been.
I just want to know, how many women work in the department?
I don't have current statistics, but I believe it's around 30 or 35. This is a department of 11,000 uniformed firefighters. There are vanishingly few women. The women who are in the position perform very well. They're fully capable, of course, of doing the job because it's, you know, it's a very difficult physical exam that you know, one must pass. But there are just very, very few women, and I would love to see a lawsuit.
Well, Dana, it's been a pleasure to have you on. We wish you continued luck and look forward to having you back on to see this thing through.
Thank you very much.
It's a pleasure to have you on the show, and we want to get you back to discuss more victories.
As part of our Lawyers You'll Like series, we're joined today by attorney Ann O'Berry. She's the vice president of the Southern Region of the National Lawyers Guild. While in law school, Ann served as a director of the Women's in Prison Project at Rikers Island in New York City, where she taught incarcerated women how to prevent termination of their parental rights. Ann clerked for federal judges in New York, New Jersey, and Pennsylvania, including the famous Judge A. Leon Higginbotham, Jr. of the Court of Appeals. She taught civil rights and South African apartheid law at the University of Pennsylvania, and then she taught race and the law at St. Thomas University Law School in Miami, Florida. In the last 12 years, Ann has served as counsel at a Florida law firm that specializes in class action litigation, particularly with environmental and privacy rights. Ann joins us today to talk more about her work as a people's lawyer.
Ann O'Berry, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
As a relatively new Guild member, we've been excited to learn about your history as a lawyer in the South. We wanted to start by asking you about the publication, The Law Only as an Enemy, that you've written. Can you tell us a bit about that and how it's informed your work?
Yes, I co-authored that with Judge Leon Higginbotham, who unfortunately passed away. But he was my mentor. I worked with him on a project regarding race in the law. He was on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Third Circuit during that time, but he was also teaching at the University of Pennsylvania Law School, along with NYU and Harvard and many other places. And he had a long-term project on race and the law. We were working on his book, and in the process, we have published various chapters out of that book. His original book was In the Matter of Color, which won a lot of awards, and this was a follow-up to that book. And the focus was basically on issues of powerlessness in terms of the law and the legal structure. And so we did a lot of historical research regarding racism and the law back in pre-Civil War Virginia. We focused on Virginia because it was a paradigm for slavery, basically, and the slave laws that were in place. We wrote an article for publication. It was published in the University of North Carolina Law Review, The Law Only as an Enemy. Basically, we analyzed the different treatment in Virginia, in pre-Civil War Virginia, depending on your status, if you were a free white person or a free black person or a slave, depending on your status, you were treated differently by the law. And what we found was, as an overall theme, depending on what the race of the victim was, that would affect what your sentence would be. For example, if a black woman was raped, that was not considered a crime. If a white woman was raped, that was considered a crime and was punishable by death. And also, if your status, if you were a black person and you stole something, you would be put to death. And it was ironic for the slave owner, because if their slaves were put to death, they had to be compensated by the state because they were considered property. So I guess what I would say about that research is that it certainly still impacts what happens today, believe it or not, many, many years later. I found that when I was doing death penalty work, for example, I did research with Professor Michael Radelet at the University of Florida, who's a sociology professor there, and he had been doing research on race and the law and how the race of the victim impacts how you are treated by the criminal justice system. And what we found was we actually went to four counties in Florida, Volusia County, St. John's County, Flagler County, and Putnam County. And what I did was I went through every single criminal case in those four counties for a certain time period. It might have been 5 or 10 years, and looked at what happened to the people that were charged. And what we found all along the way is that if the victim was black, the crime was treated less seriously than if the victim was white. If there were manslaughter, for example, if there were a killing of a child, if the child was black, the case would be treated as manslaughter. If the child was white, it was treated more seriously as a murder case. It went so far up the line as to go all the way up to whether they would seek the death penalty or not. And so I had believed prior to doing that research that what was the most significant factor was the race of the offender. But after doing this research, what we concluded is that that is a very important factor, but also the race of the victim is extremely important. They just simply treat African-American lives as less valuable than white people's lives.
And it's interesting because when I was in law school in Pennsylvania, I worked on a Baldus study going through all death-eligible case files since the time the death penalty was reinstated to look at aggravating and mitigating circumstances. And, of course, we found similar things as you've described.
How did you get involved in death penalty work? And talk to us about what you do there and what you think about it.
Well, I'm not doing it now, but I started out, I was working at a firm in New York, which was a large, prominent Wall Street-type firm. I'd gone there after law school, and the firm was known for its commitment to pro bono work. The name of the firm was Debevoise & Plimpton. And so I was, I guess what they call it, among some people, I was known as the pro bono queen because I did a lot of pro bono work while I was there. And the first pro bono.
That's great.
I was there for about 2.5 years, and the first pro bono case I did was a death penalty case We were representing Dalton Prejean from Louisiana. By the time I started working on the case, he'd already been through probably one round of direct appeals, post-conviction appeals, and we worked on his case for about 2 years, and unfortunately he was executed in May 1990. During that time that we worked on the case, he was up before the U.S. Supreme Court twice. Once, the first time, his case was up there on the issue of whether you could execute the mentally retarded, because we had evidence showing that he was mentally retarded. And the court ruled back then that it was okay. It was not unconstitutional to execute the retarded. And then separately, his case was held on the issue of whether you could execute juveniles. He was 17 at the time of his offense. And the court held at that time, yes, there's no problem, you can execute juveniles. So unfortunately, we went through I don't know how many rounds of death warrants, but as I said, in 1990, he was executed. And he was tried by an all-white jury. Dalton was black. The victim was white. The victim was a state trooper. There were not any issues of innocence in the case. It was more whether he should be executed or whether he should be allowed to serve out his life in prison. It was a very compelling case. Dalton was like a child, basically, and let's just say that along the whole entire process of his case was just a travesty from beginning to end. His attorney, his trial attorney, was drunk during the trial. The jury did not know that Dalton was retarded. In fact, they were told he was a smart kid. They didn't know he'd suffered horrendous abuse, that his mother had abandoned him when he was a child. Amazing mitigating circumstances that the jury never heard. I was so moved by that experience that I decided to give up my cushy job in New York and go do death penalty work full-time. So I ended up at the Federal Resource Center. It was a federally funded resource center doing death penalty work in Tallahassee, Florida. And I did that work from 1991 until 1996 when Congress defunded all the resource centers around the country. And then after that, I spent about a year representing women who were seeking executive clemency. It was called the Battered Women's Clemency Project in Florida. And I thought that working on cases where the clients were not going to be executed would be a little bit easier to deal with, but it wasn't, emotionally speaking. Just to meet these women who were literally fighting for their lives and defending themselves against horrendous abuse by their spouses, and who ended up, in some cases, doing life without parole. And so we were trying to get them out on clemency, and we were actually successful in getting a number of women out. So I'm not doing death penalty work at this time, but that was probably the most significant legal work that I've done.
Have there been changes in the application of the death penalty? I mean, the word better is not the word I would use, but are we making progress? I know in some other states outside of the South, we're making some progress on abolishing the death penalty. But in Florida, yeah. Georgia, Mississippi, any shifts, any Louisiana, any shifts, any changes?
Well, I will say one thing regarding just going back to Dalton's case. I mean, more recently, the U.S. Supreme Court did rule that it is unconstitutional to execute people who were juveniles at the time of the offense and unconstitutional to execute people who are mentally retarded. Florida has gotten on board with that in terms of legislation. So there is a process now for determining whether someone is mentally retarded. I see some improvements. I would say that the example of Troy Davis, unfortunately, is an example of how we have not come very far. I've seen both improvements, and I would say primarily in public opinion. We're seeing a shift in public opinion away from the death penalty because people realize, number one, there's a grave risk of executing innocent people. Number two, it's horrendously expensive to have a death penalty, and many states can't afford it. It will bankrupt a county who's trying to defend one death penalty case that's going through the system. So I'm seeing a shift away from the death penalty, and I really believe that in my lifetime, I'm 51, I believe that in my lifetime we will see the end of the death penalty in this country. I hope that's true. On the other hand, the laws, particularly on the federal level, have become much more difficult in terms of trying to persuade a court to hear your case after you've gone through one round of appeals. The procedural bars to bringing claims, even when you have very, very strong claims of actual innocence, they'll literally kick you out of court even if you're innocent. And it's just an amazing system we have where the courts will say, yes, you've got compelling evidence of innocence, but we're not going to hear your case.
It's emotionally trying to handle this kind of case. What got you through this period of time, and what motivated you?
I would say that what got me through was the victories. It was incredibly hard emotionally, and I have to say I admire the people that are still doing the work today, people who've been doing it for 20 years, 30 years. I don't know how they do it because it takes a piece out of you. It really does. It changes you doing this work when you come to care for your clients, and if they end up being executed, I mean, there's just nothing worse that I can think of. But what got me through was the wins. When we would win, the sense of victory and justice, you feel like if you fight hard enough, maybe you can win. And I'm happy to say that in the cases that I worked on, where I was primarily the attorney responsible for the case, I don't believe that I had a single case that ended up with an execution. And so I poured my heart and soul into it. I would say that my personal life was non-existent, but it didn't matter to me because I was doing something that I believed in so fundamentally. And to be able to go to your client and say, you got to stay and you're going to live another day, and then ultimately for them to get off death row, there's just no greater feeling. And so what got me through was the successes and the support of the people that were doing the work. I mean, there was a tremendous camaraderie among the people that were doing this work.
But you're still doing political work. You're still doing legal work. Can you just talk about some of that?
Sure. Well, a lot of the work I'm doing now is actually, with the Guild. I'm the regional vice president for the Guild. As Heidi mentioned, I'm a relatively new member. I wish I had joined a long time ago. But the work that I'm doing with the Guild is just the most incredible work, and I'm just so happy to be doing it. And as far as, you know, actual lawyer work, presently I'm working with an attorney, Jim Green, who's a prominent civil rights attorney in West Palm Beach, kind of a legend down here, and I'm very fortunate to be working with him. He does a lot of civil rights, constitutional litigation. We represent people with disabilities, so we do a lot of work with under the ADA and also the Fair Housing Act.
And we're very, very fortunate to have you among our ranks. You're truly a fine people's lawyer. I look forward to working with you down in Tampa and want to thank you for all the great work you've done over the years.
Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
People in the villages of the Mayan highlands suffered the worst of the army's brutality in the early 1980s during Guatemala's 36-year-old civil war. To talk about the convictions and the Guatemalan genocide and the U.S. complicity in all of this, we're joined today by Kate Doyle, director of the National Security Archive Guatemala Project.
Welcome, Kate Doyle, to Law and Disorder.
Thank you, Heidi.
Kate, you're with one of our favorite organizations, the National Security Archives. In fact, we got a lot of help from your folks when Michael Ratner and I did that book about the CIA's assassinating Che. But you're with the Guatemalan project there. Tell us a little bit about what your responsibilities are at the National Security Archive.
Sure, Michael. I'm one of a couple of analysts at the archive that look at U.S. foreign policy in Latin America. My specialty is Central America and Mexico. And I'm the director of something called the Evidence Project at the Archive, which is a way of connecting the right to information, the right to truth, with human rights and justice struggles around the region. So we've worked very closely with truth commissions, with prosecutors and judges, to try to get some of the declassified U.S. documents, and sometimes even the national documents from their countries, into their hands when they've got a human rights investigation underway.
Today we wanted to talk specifically about the trial of former Guatemalan dictator Efren Rios Montt, along with his intelligence chief, José Rodríguez Sánchez, which, as I understand it, had a rather surprising outcome.
It did, Heidi. This is a case that was originally filed in the year 2000. So this is a case that's been working for years and years and years inside Guatemala. The impetus for this case really came from the affected communities themselves. That is, in this case, the community of the Maya Ishil in the Quiché department of Guatemala in the northwestern part of the country, which worked for really decades to both identify exhumation sites, sites where they knew there were clandestine mass graves of their own mothers, fathers, children, brothers, sisters, who had been massacred during the scorched earth operations of Rios Montt in 1982 and 1983, and also to tell their stories, their testimonies, which have been provided to human rights investigators, to truth commissions, and now finally in a national courtroom before all of Guatemala, helped bring this trial about.
Before we go into the details, can you just give us a brief background on the scorched earth?
Yes. In March of 1982, Rios Montt headed a trio of military officers that overthrew the previous president, Romeo Lucas Garcia, in a coup d'etat and took power. There was a guerrilla armed insurgency underway in Guatemala, and it had been since the 1960s. And Rios Montt and his junta, and what was eventually ultimately just Rios Montt, just a couple of months later when he seized power entirely for himself, decided that they were going to launch a series of intensive counterinsurgency operations, not only to target the armed insurgents in the highlands, but also to destroy or eliminate their social base. And that meant actually eliminating, going after the communities of mostly Mayan indigenous peoples that were living in the same region where the guerrillas operated. Those scorched earth operations resulted not only in the deaths of hundreds and hundreds of the Maya Ishil, but the destruction of their communities, the burning of their homes, the killing of their animals, the destruction of their crops, and the bombing of people who tried to flee as they sought refuge in the mountain. It was really one of the most extraordinary and brutal acts of what used to be called low-intensity warfare that Latin America and even the world has known. The officials that carried out those operations were left to enjoy total impunity after the regime ended some 17 months later. And it wasn't until a group of the same Maya Ishil who had been affected by them banded together to try to push some kind of judicial accountability and succeeded in getting this case underway.
Kate, what did it take to get the case actually in front of a judge?
Well, between the time the case was filed in the year 2000 and 2013, when we finally had the case go before Judge Yasmin Barrios and her two supportive judges in the tribunal, the prosecutors, both the government prosecutor and what are called in Guatemala the querellantes, who are the civil prosecutors who represent the victims, who also get to sit at the table, ask questions, and participate in the investigation, pulled together a really extraordinary case for genocide and crimes against humanity against this dictator, Rios Montt, and his intelligence chief, Rodríguez Sánchez, that you mentioned, Heidi. And the case consisted of almost 100 witnesses or survivors from the massacres who came and told their just heart-rending stories of losing their family members, of terrible cases of rape and violence to children. And in combination with some 40 experts from all around the world on issues such as racism in Guatemala, a key issue when you're trying to establish a case of genocide, on issues such as the military strategies and plans that were behind the operations, and other related issues. And they had, finally, some key documents that they brought as evidence in this case. And I think it was the combination of this tremendous prosecution that the lawyers were able to pull together over the course of years with the help of the Maya community that made this case such a success.
And you were down there for some of the trial, weren't you?
I was. I was there for almost a month of the trial. I have been working with those prosecutors for years to help them incorporate both declassified U.S. documents as evidence in the case, but also the those Guatemalan military archives that we were able to get our hands on. And it was very, very few. They're very few, but they're very powerful and very important to the case. So those documents were brought as evidence, and it was really exciting and satisfying to hear them cited constantly during the course of the trial.
Tell us a bit more about the process of gathering this evidence in terms of your involvement in the case. Does that involve finessing the U.S. government? How long does it take to get documents released? How difficult is it?
The National Security Archives Guatemala Project actually started in 1994. And I launched it then because we found out that a side accord to what would eventually become the peace accords in Guatemala, signed in 1996, mandated the creation of an eventual truth commission. And in anticipation of that truth commission, knowing that the truth commission would likely have little or no access to Guatemalan military archives within Guatemala, we decided to use the Freedom of Information Act to try to pry out the documents that our own government kept from the CIA, the State Department, the embassy in Guatemala, and the defense attachés that were posted there for decades. Because of the very tight relationship between the United States and the Guatemalan regime of Rios Montt and predecessor regimes, we knew that these agencies would have countless records of the operations themselves, of the Guatemalan military structure and command and control, and all kinds of issues that related ultimately to the case, and that proved to be in fact the case.
When you were observing the trial, what were some of the highlights when you were down there that you saw?
It's hard to call them highlights because so many of the amazing, powerful moments were, in fact, heartbreaking moments.
Yeah, I'm sorry for I couldn't think of a better word, but help us describe into our audience what it was like when you were down there.
Some of the most extraordinary testimony for me came from women because the Guatemalan military, like so many militaries in these sort of irregular wars or counterinsurgencies, used sexual abuse and sexual violation as a part of their counterinsurgency tactics. And they actually, talk about the destruction of the semilla, the seed, and ways in which to control and ultimately destroy the Maya population. And one of those ways was to kill children, number one, and rape the women, number two. And so there was a day in which a group of women came and testified before the judge, one after another, each one with her face covered with a sort of beautiful woven cloth that she had brought to help protect her identity, but spoke in the most direct and affecting terms about exactly what happened and how rape was used to brutalize her and silence her. And I would say one of the things that happened in the courtroom is that a lot of the women in the courtroom took scarves or pieces of cloth or sweaters they had with them and covered their heads in solidarity as the women spoke. And it was just one of those kind of chilling moments that you'll never forget for the rest of your life, the bravery of the women to come forward and speak openly in that way.
And what kind of media coverage was there locally about this process?
Very, very strong media coverage. It was not possible to sort of silence or cover up this process. I mean, that was one of the reasons why it was so important that this case be brought to trial, because for once we were in a public space. These witnesses who had given their testimonies perhaps dozens of times to human rights investigators in the past, within their own family, sharing them with truth commissions, for the first time ever were able to speak publicly, were able to have their words officially recorded. There was a tremendous amount of press coverage of the trial, and it ended up on the front page of most newspapers pretty much every day.
What was the theory of the case that the private defense lawyers put on in terms of Efren Montt and Jose Sanchez?
The defense lawyers struggled to put together any defense at all, to be honest. Their basic line was that Rios Montt, and I'll just speak about him, Rios Montt was the commander of the country, the commander-in-chief of the armed forces, but was not present when these crimes were committed. So right there, we knew we had an opening, because at that level, we knew that there was acknowledgement of the massacres, acknowledgement of the violence. They were simply trying to separate their client from what had happened, and it just wasn't possible. But you know, overall, Heidi, when you look at the duration and length of this trial, the prosecution presented an overwhelming case, and the defense lawyers had to resort very quickly to all kinds of legal machinations to try to stop the case, delay the case, obstruct the case. They must have put 18, 20, 25 appeals, I don't know how many different legal motions to try to get this case stopped, which they were unsuccessful in doing.
Talk to us about the last day, the day when the verdict came down.
The day the verdict came down, the courtroom, which probably seats somewhere around 500 people, was absolutely packed to the gills. So every seat was full. People were sitting on their laps. People were in the aisles in between, sitting on the steps. And there was a gigantic crowd of press right down in the trial area, because there was no place else to be. And essentially what happened, the three judges filed into the courtroom. Judge Barrios, who's the president of the tribunal, began to read the justification for what would be the verdict. And so she sort of highlighted various aspects of some of the witness testimony, the expert testimony, and ultimately announced that our verdict is that Rios Montt is guilty for genocide and crimes against humanity. And the courtroom couldn't help it. People broke out in cheers and sobs and applause. When the mood in the room began to feel tense because of the sort of just the intensity of that verdict and what that meant for Guatemala, everybody stood up and began to sing this beautiful song that was set. It was actually a poem of a great Guatemalan poet named Otto René Castillo, who was assassinated in the 1960s. And they all stood up and sang this poem that has been set to music by a Guatemalan musician over and over again, and brought the tension in the room down slowly, slowly. It was one of the most beautiful moments I've ever witnessed in a courtroom.
Now, what kind of punishment will be meted out to Rios Montt?
He was condemned to 80 years in prison for the crimes, 50 years for genocide, and 30 years for the various other crimes against humanity, as they called them. Whether or not Rios Montt will serve beyond the two nights in jail that we know he has served, he went to Matamoros prison directly from the courtroom, is anyone's guess. He's a tremendously old person. He's not a well person. He's, I think, 87 or even 88 by now. And yesterday, I believe, on the way to the courtroom to hear the reparations phase of the trial, because they're now discussing what does the government have to do to repair what happened, he apparently fainted and was brought to a prison hospital. So it's not clear how many of those years he will serve, but he was condemned to 80 years in jail.
I read that he was so arrogant that after the sentence came down, he got up and was going to just walk out of the courtroom.
One of the tense moments in that long, very intense day was after the verdict was read, Rios Montt and his defense lawyers began to try to leave. And Judge Barrios actually had to stand up and call into, even shout into the microphone, stop him, stop those lawyers, close the doors, I want security here now. It was a little scary.
And I wanted to ask quickly, what kind of security was there throughout the trial?
There was a fair amount of security. You saw the National Civil Police at the doors. You saw special court officers all over the room. You even saw members of the military at certain highly tense moments in the course of the trial. That said, one day, as part of the tactics to try to obstruct the case, the entire table of defense lawyers, and there must have been six or seven of them in there that day, decided to protest what was happening and got up and walked out of the room and abandoned their clients. Judge Barrios reacted by calling out to the court officers to stop them, because they weren't allowed by law to leave their client abandoned at the table, and the officers simply stood there. So we weren't quite sure to what extent the security was on the judge's side or not, but certainly nothing bad happened during the trial, and we should be grateful for that.
let's just leave Rios Montt in his prison cell and go to what I think is an extremely important subject, and that is, to what extent was the United States complicit in this? And secondly, would have happened at all without United States complicity?
The United States overthrew the democratically elected president of Guatemala in 1954. The CIA was directly responsible for engineering that coup and installing a military dictator in his stead. That was really the beginning of the unraveling of Guatemala, I would say. And the armed insurgency began just a few years afterwards, frustrated by the strength of the dictator, military dictators, and the refusal to permit democratic political activity in the country. So you have a kind of beginning of the end right there in the 1950s with U.S. direct support and involvement. What happened after that is the United States, seeing Guatemala as a key strategic player in the U.S. national interests in the region, in Central America, to stop the advance of communism, especially after the triumph of Castro in Cuba in 1959, the United States began to invest heavily, first millions, then tens of millions of dollars in the Guatemalan army, in the Guatemalan military intelligence, and built up this thing that became the killing machine that the Guatemalan army was when Rios Montt took over. Was the United States on the ground in 1982 and pouring millions of dollars into weapons the way we were in El Salvador? In 1982, they were not. We had millions of dollars flowing through CIA covert aid. But essentially, because of Jimmy Carter's human rights policy, we had cut off all overt aid. And that cutoff remained until well into the 1980s, long past Rios Montt. So there is a kind of, what we say in Latin America, intellectual authorship of the United States government in what happened during the genocide. U.S. national security doctrine, with which all of the key military officers were trained in U.S. military schools. U.S. early support for the Guatemalan military, the structure of its intelligence, and its ideological component. All of that is, I believe, sort of the burden that the United States carries in the genocide that ultimately unfolded there.
Did any of this come out at trial? Was this a part of any of the testimony?
It really wasn't, Heidi, although we in the United States, I think, have an obligation now to explore this further, to investigate it, to call out those officials who were involved in these policies. Certainly, there were officials like Elliot Abrams, there were officials like Stephen Bosworth, there were officials like President Reagan himself, who called Rios Montt a democratic man, a man of integrity and courage, who said he had had a bum rap in the human rights accusations that had come against him. Our responsibility now is to identify those people and call them out. That really wasn't an issue inside the courtroom. The Guatemalans were, and properly so, focused on legally convicting the author of genocide, and they did it.
Kate Doyle, before we let you go, and I promise you we're going to have you back for further developments on America's complicity in this, let's talk about the current government of Guatemala and their complicity in this.
The current Guatemalan government is run by President Otto Perez Molina, who was in fact a commander in the Ixil region, the very same region where the genocide took place, in 1982 when Rios Montt ran the armed forces. And there's already evidence that Perez Molina was involved not simply by being present, but was actually present when killings took place, was involved in, there is evidence now and testimony that he was present when torture took place and that he himself tortured and killed. That said, I think right now what Guatemala has done has identified the intellectual author, the person who was responsible not only for designing the genocide, but for ordering the genocide, but for making sure it was carried out, for accepting the reports that were sent back up from the field, and for prodding it along for the months that he was in office. Whether Perez Molina, who was a major at the time, and all the other hundreds of majors and captains and lieutenants that were actually in the field will ever see a prosecution is anyone's guess. That would be a tremendous political challenge for any country, and certainly in Guatemala, I think, especially.
Before we conclude, I wanted to just ask for your parting thoughts on what the next months and years may hold in terms of reparations. either symbolically or practically?
Judge has listed already some very important reparations, has required, for example, that the state build schools in the affected areas and incorporate what happened and the genocide conviction itself into the curricula of these schools and schools all over the country, of course. There are other reparations more typical to these to human rights crimes, such as the building of monuments, the naming of scholarships. The disappointment in the reparation phase was that the judges turned down the request from the Maya Ishil to return lands that had been seized from them after their communities were burnt, destroyed, and they were either killed or escaped. So that was a real blow, and I think that will become a subject of a lot of debate in the months to come.
Is there a website if listeners are interested in learning more, or a place you could direct them to?
Absolutely. The National Security Archive has a whole bunch of declassified documents about our role in Guatemala and about the trial. You can see it at www.nsarchiv.org.
And we'll put a link to that on our website. Kate, it was lovely to have you on to discuss a really painful topic, but an important development.
Thank you so much, Heidi. Michael.
Thank you, Kate, for being on Law and Disorder.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.